Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a show I've been waiting for a long time, a guest I've been trying to get for a couple of years now. The editor of the great trade publication, editor and publisher, Greg Mitchell, will be joining us to discuss his brand new book, So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq, an extraordinary new book of press criticism. So join us today on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Last December, the FCC voted to eliminate the longstanding ban on newspaper broadcast cross-ownership, which prohibits one company from owning a broadcast station and the major daily newspaper in the same market. This week, the Senate introduced legislation that would overturn that decision. Senator Byron Dorgan, a Democrat from North Dakota, introduced a resolution of disapproval on Wednesday that would nullify the FCC's new rules.
This is about the subject of concentration in the media. We have seen galloping concentration in radio and television. It is unhealthy, in my judgment, unhealthy to a democracy. The Federal Communications Commission is supposed to be the referee, and instead they have joined those shaking the pom-poms for more concentration.
Dorgan called the FCC's action arrogant, in disregard of the public interest, and a cave-in to the corporate interests. He criticized FCC Chairman Kevin Martin for a flawed process in which he announced the rules in the New York Times and gave the public just 28 days to respond.
He likes to say that he gave 120 days, but the fact is he did not. He held some hearings around the country, but that was prior to any rule announcement, so no one knew what the rules might be and didn't until he put it in the New York Times.
Dorgan also said that Martin's purported rationale for loosening the cross-ownership ruling to help ailing newspapers was wrong.
The fact is, newspapers have an average net income of about 15% to 20%, which is still well above most other corporations. Newspapers aren't in trouble. Newspapers, in most cases, are still making a very healthy income.
Dorgan takes issue with those who say we have more choices for news and information than ever before because of the internet.
I've said often it is more voices and the same ventriloquist.
Dorgan's resolution now has 14 bipartisan co-sponsors, including Senator Barack Obama, Senator Hillary Clinton, Senator Olympia Snow, and Senator Ted Stevens. The resolution has 60 days on the legislative calendar to pass the Senate. Dorgan hopes the resolution will be voted on by early April. For more information, go to stopbigmedia.com.
Ready? Okay! 2, 4, 6, 8! Who do we consolidate? Media! Media! More media!
By the way, that would have been way better with our pom-poms. They, like, took them at security. So.
This just in. The media love a horse race. That news won't be shocking to anyone who's watched coverage of the 2008 campaign. But just how much news coverage is devoted to polls, predictions, and punditry instead of policies might surprise you. The University of Missouri is in the midst of a study analyzing news stories about the 2008 presidential race. The results of more than 800 stories from USA Today are in. They reveal that 56% were about the election horse race, while statements about the candidates' policies only took up 15%. Professor William Benoit is the author of several books on political campaigns and has studied election campaign coverage from 1952 to 2000. Horse race reporting has always been there, he says, and will probably continue because it's easier than reporting on the issues.
It is just not possible for any reporter to be an expert on gun control, abortion, immigration, jobs in Ohio, NAFTA, Iraq, Afghanistan. I mean, you cannot be an expert on all the aspects of policy. But it's easy for a reporter to become an expert on the horse race.
Benoit says that reporters have more objectivity about the campaigns than the candidates themselves, but that doesn't translate to good information about policy.
Many voters believe the news is a better source of information, and there are some ways in which that's true, but they are not better sources of information because they talk more about policy. The fact that they focus on the horse race, for whatever reason they do that, means that voters know less about policy than they would otherwise.
When they aren't talking about the horse race, reporters dwell more on the character of the candidates than the issues. The USA Today statistics show that 29% of the articles focus on character.
I do think character is important, but it's not valuable to learn more about character than about policy. I would say they should be weighted more equally, or maybe there should be even somewhat more emphasis on policy than on characters.
Professor Benoit says the results of the study, which will include analysis of other major newspapers and national TV networks, will be published after the primary campaign is over. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, this March 9th, 2008. Today we have as a guest someone, as I said at the top of the show, I've been eager to have for quite some time. Greg Mitchell is the editor of Editor and Publisher, the venerable publication of the newspaper industry, which has been around for 125 years, author of 8 books, including one I had the great privilege of reading and using in my research, The Campaign of the Century, Upton Sinclair's Race for Governor of California and the Birth of Modern Politics, and a person who has emerged over the last 5 years as arguably the leading press critic of how the newspaper industry and the media in general have covered the U.S. war in Iraq. So it's a privilege to have him with us today. Greg Mitchell, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. I'm very happy to be here.
And your new book, So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq, is just come out. Is that true?
That's right, just this week, yeah.
And, you know, one thing I should say to folks, even though I read Editor and Publisher as part of my research, I know it's not really something you find on newsstands. Folks wanting to get a hold of your work and your commentary on the press and on politics can go to the internet. I know that you've got a web blog there, and I've got it bookmarked. What is the web address on it?
Well, the address for Editor and Publisher itself, where I post my columns, and we have a lot of other, you know, terrific stories about related to the war and the media and criticism and so forth, is at www.editorandpublisher.com. Mm-hmm. And then I now just very recently have a blog launched, which is at gregmitchellwriter.blogspot.com.
So I assume if someone just enters Greg Mitchell and or Editor and Publisher, they're going to end up at those sites.
They could be.
And, you know, I've been reading your work for years and just been struck when I was reading Editor and Publisher in the, you know, 4 or 5 years ago about how brilliant these editorials were, that you were doing really well ahead of the pack. And this book basically draws together 75 or so of your pieces over the last 5 or 6 years. Is that right?
Well, I don't know about the brilliant part, but it was fairly prescient, perhaps. Yeah, the book is... I mean, it brings together about 80 of the columns, but it's much more than that. I think of it as the first history of the entire war. I can't think of another book that really covers the full 5 years from the run-up to the surge, the debate over the surge as late as last November. So it's literally a five-year history, and there's a chronology in that each of these chapters has a lead-in that goes through the main events in the war and in the media, so it's really a month by month accounting of the war, with, you know, broken by these by my columns. It also has a foreword by Joe Galloway, the famed war reporter who was one of the first pundits to call for a withdrawal from Iraq. There's a brief preface by Bruce Springsteen, and there's a lengthy introduction by myself that's brand new.
Our guest, Greg Mitchell, has just been talking about his brand new book, So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq, just out as we speak this week. And one of the things that was striking as I was reading the book, Greg, was what you said. There's really, there's been a lot to write about. I mean, this is, it's not, you know, there, I mean, I was making up a list of issues to talk about, and literally I had two full pages, single-spaced of material ranging from, you know, Jessica Lynch and Mission Accomplished to The Surge, to Judith Miller, to Abu Ghraib. I mean, there's really been a wealth of material here.
Well, you know, the media has been in the center of things, of course, for over 5 years, going back to kind of blowing the run-up to the war. So I think maybe I was a little surprised when I started putting it together to find out that you really could do a history of the whole war just by focusing on the media reaction, the media mistakes, some of the good things the media did, all the controversies. It seems like whether it's the Pat Tillman scandal or all the Scooter Libby stuff and everything, the debate over, for example, John McCain's visit to Iraq last year and so forth. So it was a little surprising, but you really can tell the whole history and the debate over the war and the debate over the coverage just by focusing on the media.
I'd like to go through a lot of the stuff you write about in here, some of the key episodes, some of the stuff you already mentioned. But before we do, I mean, the title sort of tips us off, So Wrong for So Long. But, I mean, what are the, if you could say, what's the takeaway here, the overarching themes or arguments you're trying to make in the book?
Well, I think it comes out to breaking it down into three types of media coverage, I guess. One is the reporting here at home, mainly out of Washington. Then you have the reporting out of Iraq itself, and then you have the editorial commentary and the punditry. Three quite different areas, and I think the three areas have varied, not so much where you can kind of generalize about any of them. It seemed to vary by period. For example, the often critical of the reporting, the straight reporting, mainly out of Washington, on the run-up to the war, the blowing the WMD and the Al-Qaeda links and so forth, that has improved somewhat over the years. As we know, a lot of reporters, I think, felt a little guilty about it, and there has been some tough coverage out of Washington, and we know there's been a lot of tough coverage on related issues like the Walter Reed and so on and so forth. So you can find reporters and coverage at the Washington Post and the New York Times. It's been quite good out of Washington, but they really missed the key moment in why we're still talking about this 5 years later. Now, reporting out of Iraq, similar. There was too much rah-rah coverage in the early, in the actual invasion, and then the months afterwards. The embedding of reporters had some good points, but it also had some bad points. But again, after months and now years have passed, the book, you know, hails, you know, some or a lot of the coverage in Iraq by individual reporters and certain news services and so forth. There's been a lot of tough coverage and a lot of bravery shown by reporters, along with some disappointing coverage. And then finally, in terms of editorials and punditry, actually looking back, there was a surprising amount of skepticism among editorial and editorial pages. We all know how awful most of the Washington Post columnists were and editorial page and so forth. But there was,
you richly skewer in the book, I might add.
And there were a surprising number of editorial pages who were at least weren't saying the war is a bad idea, and they weren't saying that Saddam does not have WMD or anything like that. They were just saying, we may be rushing, let's give the inspectors more time to work, what's the hurry, and so forth. And also public opinion polls. We've heard a million times pundits say on TV that, public was all for this, and everyone wanted to go into war, but, you know, the book points out that Gallup polls and so forth showed that 40 to 50% of the people were saying they weren't in a rush, or let's wait, let's not go now. And it doesn't mean that people were pro-Saddam, but there was a surprising amount of hesitancy. But then, again, one of the key narratives of the entire book is every few months I had to write a column saying, when is one single major editorial page going to come out and call for a withdrawal? The beginning of a withdrawal, a phased withdrawal, the change of course, not immediate departure. But and it, month after month, and then year after year passed, and it's only been in the past year that we've seen some of that. So I think the editorial pages and the pundits, some of whom were not bad in the run-up to the war, then really let down for months and years afterwards. So it's not a, you know, it's a complicated picture.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Greg Mitchell, who you've just been listening to, the editor of Editor and Publisher, the venerable trade publication of the news industry, and also the author of the brand-new book, So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Greg Mitchell, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And Greg, one of the things that struck me as I was reading the book was, you know, currently we hear politicians often say, especially if they're running for higher office, that they, you know, didn't know in 2002 about the weapons of mass destruction. They were going on the intelligence, so they can't really be faulted.
Right.
And as I read your columns in the book and read your assessment, that really doesn't hold together at all.
Well, there were a lot of questions raised early on. And it's become almost a cliche to praise the McClatchy or the was the Knight Ridder Washington office now known as McClatchy,
Jonathan Landay,
right? But they did raise a number of those issues repeatedly during the run up to the war. But they are not the New York Times or the Washington Post and so forth. And I think as we show in the book, it's not that the Times and the Post did not have any skeptical stories, but they were buried on page 28, while the scare stories were on page 1. So, that's the real difference. And I think, there were people in Congress who voted against the resolution. There were people in the press who were against the war. There certainly were millions of people in the streets against the war. There were people at certainly the United Nations. And really, one of the biggest myths of the entire experience was we still hear President Bush and others still say, well, you know, we had to go in there because, the inspections, there were no inspections, and we couldn't get inspections to work, and so on and so forth. But, of course, the UN had inspectors on the ground there for weeks in just before the war started. They were finding absolutely nothing. They were being mocked for not finding anything. And, they were only pulled out in the final days before the war when they didn't particularly want to get bombed.
You know, I think that fact is largely unknown to most Americans
this
day.
Right, but it's the repeating. You know, you kind of repeat a myth often enough, as we know with the media, and it becomes the conventional wisdom. You say, hey, wait a minute. These guys were on the ground and not finding anything. You know, when you think about it, we probably can remember that day when they supposedly Iraq had all these drones that could carry chemicals or biological agents, and then, the inspectors found these, like, plywood little planes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they found. That was a one-day story, but the myth is that the inspections were not just not happening. We had to go in there.
One of the issues, Greg Mitchell, you take up in the book is the cost of the war and the press coverage of the actual cost of this war and occupation in Iraq. And since the book has been completed just recently, Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, has a new book out, which you blog about, I see,
right?
Where he says that the entire cost, when you really get into the books and see where they're hiding the money and what the actual cost for the war and occupation will be, may well be in the $3 trillion range.
Right.
Why has this issue sort of fallen from view in our news coverage? I mean, the cost issue, in your view?
That's a good question. I don't quite understand it myself. In fact, if you remember back even to the 2004 presidential campaign, I remember screaming at the TV set a few times that I couldn't understand why John Kerry was not raising that issue so much. Because it's a nonpartisan issue in a sense, it's something everyone should be concerned about. It's something that affects everyone, including the proverbial children or grandchildren. I'm not quite sure why. It's something that I think there's a sense in America that, we can pay. If we want something badly enough, we can pay for it and pass it on. But it's great that it's getting attention now. And the other thing that I cover, talk about costs, that I cover continually in the book, and I think I was one of the first to, in the mainstream, to focus on this, was the cost to our veterans, both in terms of injuries and the mental and physical damage for tens of thousands that are going to continue, but also the focusing on the deaths in Iraq from accidents and illness and suicides. I think I was probably among the first to focus on the mental problems of soldiers and veterans, the surge in suicides, massive number of suicides both there and at home. I've written about that for almost 5 years and you know, did a column in the past week on this. So,
could you give a little more, Greg, I'm not to interrupt you, but this is such an important issue, and you really do get a lot of the credit for raising it as much as humanly possible. How many, to our knowledge, how many veteran suicides have there been? How does this compare to other generations of soldiers right. or other wars?
Well, you know, they're not really officially counted. The Iraq casualty coalition casualty site, the excellent site, manages to get some kind of figures, and they update it periodically, and so that the actual investigations that are ended and officially branded as suicides by the Pentagon, there's been, I think the latest number is 144, but there are hundreds of other cases that were unresolved that were probably suicide, but they don't want to label them that. There are hundreds of others that are still under investigation. And there have been hundreds or thousands back at home. I wrote about a case a week ago. That was the first time I've picked up the morning paper near where I live outside New York City here. And there was a local fellow who had Iraq vet, and it was just a typical story that's going on all over the country. Just came back, had post-traumatic stress. You know, his wife couldn't deal with him. He wasn't getting help with the Veterans Hospital. And after being back home for a year, after two tours in Iraq, he hung himself. And this was, you know, 5 miles from my home here, and et cetera, et cetera. So this is going on all over the country. Like I said, I wrote about this for 4 years, and finally, starting last winter, CBS and New York Times and other places started covering this a lot and came up with numbers, again, in the thousands. I can't quote the exact number, but in the thousands of vets who have killed, Iraq vets who have killed themselves.
Is the Bush administration being really helpful in trying to get to the bottom of this?
Well, I you know, it's a Pentagon thing. I really don't know. It's certainly not well publicized except when the media does pay attention to it. And like I said, it has been the last year. We had the Walter Reed scandal and other things. It's really the past year we've started to see a lot of more emphasis on the injured vets. I put up a story at our website yesterday that I'm not sure it got a lot of attention elsewhere, but there was a study that found that 70,000 Iraq vets are now being treated for serious hearing loss. That's just for one, you know, one problem. 70,000 just for hearing loss, you know, hearing loss or hearing severe hearing problems coming out of the war. And there was a story a couple days before that, that from AP that we put up, which showed that 330,000 will be seeking treatment for some medical or physical problem in 2008. That's 330,000 vets from Iraq or Afghanistan. So, you know, the numbers are staggering.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Greg Mitchell, author of the brand new book, So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. Greg Mitchell is the editor and publisher and author of numerous fine books. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Greg Mitchell, the number here is 333-9455 at WILL-AM 580. Also, you can call our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line one, you're on the air with Greg Mitchell.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Given the tremendous cost of the war, which you've elaborated and alluded to, it's maybe even bigger than we know of. I wondered, this is a preposterous notion, I suppose, but what are the chances, and if so, by whom, would it be done of seeking judicial recompense by
right.
the courts?
Right.
Against the people who really wanted this war. They ought to have to pay their fair share, it seems.
Well, you know, it's it'll be interesting on a number of fronts, including all various legal things involving the Plame case and the firing of the U.S. attorneys, and you can name one scandal after another. What will happen after the elections this November?
Dean is elected, of course, we'll he still have to answer for these things because he's a Republican, and it's sort of a continuation of the Bush White House. If a Democrat gets in, will there be a sense of dropping all this? It's like, okay, it's old news. We're gonna have enough problems moving forward. So let's not talk about the firing of the U.S. attorneys or why we got into the war or anything like that. So I wouldn't be optimistic that we're gonna get to the bottom of a lot of these scandals. That there's going to be a certain turning of the page, but yeah, we'll see.
You know, one of the issues, Greg Mitchell, that you write about in the book. A little bit, but still, you know, it's been quite controversial, has been the number of Iraqi deaths due to the invasion and the occupation. This is something that, you know, there have been a couple of studies that have come out through Johns Hopkins and through British researchers, which have suggested the Iraqi deaths due to the U.S. invasion and occupation may approach 1 million.
Right.
And these are not wild-eyed sources. These are actually extraordinarily credible. Yet it's interesting, they've been dismissed almost categorically as, you know, whack job research because it's such an embarrassing number.
Right. Well, we ran a column on our site a couple weeks ago by John Turman, who was got the study going, which he answered some of the a lot of the critiques against the studies and so forth. And, you know, I'm not enough of an expert to judge whether these studies, you know, are way off or a little off or not off at all. I know a lot of people in the field have said that they were set up soundly. That's the thing that people overlook. But the true experts say these are valid studies. Now, the studies may have gotten twisted. They may have been not gotten the accurate results for one reason or another, but they're not seen as whack job studies.
You know, but striking to me, Greg, is that you know, here we are liberating a country ostensibly, freeing its people from the yoke of tyranny, and there's like a concerted effort, it seems like, to not determine exactly the extent of the cost these free people are paying.
Right. Well, of course, as you know, the cost is also in the 2 or 3 million who have fled the country. I mean, it's just a massive exodus. It's on so many levels. One of the things I cover in the book, because you can get down to individual cases in a sense, is looking at the civilian casualties in terms of these payments we make. It's too much to go into here, but we do have what they call condolence payments to families there. And the ACLU managed to get at hundreds of case files on cases where families were paid off because someone in the family was killed. And I reprinted a lot of them. Again, I think I was the first one to really do that, reprinted a lot of the excerpts from the files. You know, and it's just shocking, the casual shooting of, you know, kids walking down the street and get shot, or, you know, or just the bomb gets, you know, lands on the family and they get paid $2,000 or something. So sometimes you have to look at the individual cases to sort of see what the day-to-day life might be like.
Our guest, Greg Mitchell, you're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about his brand new book, So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed in Iraq. Greg Mitchell is the editor and publisher, the venerable publication of the newspaper industry for some 125 years.
I haven't been there for that entire period.
When did you go there, Greg, by the way?
Been there for a while, but...
I must ask you, before we get to the next caller who's waiting patiently, I read your columns, and I just wonder... how do you keep your job exactly? I bet you've been asked that before.
I try not to answer it. I don't know. I mean, it's a long story, but I sort of ended up, I've written about 8 books, and I just finished a couple books, and I knew a couple people who worked at EMP, and I was hired there as a features editor, and then the editors above me departed, and I became editor, and now, whether it's just coincidence or I've done some good work, but the magazine, since I took over, has kind of flourished. We've won the top awards for the business press from actually fairly conservative organizations, or the Pulitzers of the business press, you might say. We've been one of the most successful magazines in the whole country in winning these Pulitzers for the business press. So we've built up cachet. Our website's become tremendously popular. So I don't know. Maybe they're not paying so much attention. They figure, well, we've been successful, so leave well enough alone. So it is. Some people do think it's kind of odd.
Well, I read the business press for my research constantly across all the media industries, and editor and publisher is striking in the quality of, and originality of the content.
Well, I appreciate that.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Let's go to line two, Champagne. You're on the air with Greg Mitchell.
Oh, hi. I should preface this by saying I'm opposed to the war, and I'm eager for us to get out. But what I don't hear much information about is what you, assuming we get out, what you see in terms of building up the country, the kind of government they would have, just kind of what you foresee, assuming that we get out.
Best case scenario, sort of.
Or worse, whichever.
Well, we don't want the worst.
Accurate.
Nobody wants the worst case scenario. That's for sure.
No.
Well, I mean, I think it is. There is the question, and this is, I guess, the Obama line, which is that they're not going to the Iraqis themselves, the various factions and the government are not going to take it seriously in terms of getting their own country together until we start to leave, and that us leaving will inspire them to come together, and that then they will have, it'll be a happier solution. Now, of course, the opposing view, which might be called the McCain view, is if we even say we're going to leave, then, it's just going to fall apart there, and things are going to be worse, and there'll be a civil war, and, 5 million will die. So, that's the open question.
Greg, let me ask you about the McCain view, if I can, because I also get a sense that the undercurrent in the McCain view, to use, and it's not just McCain who holds it, obviously, but of that argument, is that we shouldn't ever leave, really. I mean, realistically, we just have, you can't say it publicly, but
right,
we've got to regard Iraq like, as he puts it, South Korea.
Right, no, exactly. Well, it's totally, of course, misremembering the totally different wars and the totally different, of course, Korea was, there was an army from the north and there was a stalemate, and you could draw this line in the peninsula and say, a demilitarized zone and so forth. Iraq, of course, is completely different history, and everything about it is completely different. But more than that, what I'm afraid of is that, and I'm sure you're very aware of this since you've been around for a while, as I have.
Yeah, I have.
There's a huge numbers of people in the country who are still upset we didn't win in Vietnam, who still feel we should have. Who, there became the acceptance by most people that Vietnam was a mistake and terrible thing, and let's get over it. But the millions and millions of people still sticks in their craw that, we didn't win. It's considered kind of a loss. We could have, and in their view, we could have won. We should have won if we stayed longer, if we applied more force, then we would have won. It's like a black eye. And I think McCain feels that way himself. He may not have expressed it that much over the years. I don't think it's something, talking about Vietnam is not easy for a lot of people to do, to express that so openly, but I think he's one of those people that's kind of stuck in his craw. Now, he, of course, has personal reasons as well, but and so what I'm afraid is there's a feeling of we're not going to walk away, and McCain says this openly, and we're not going to walk away without a win. It's shocking the last year. The people, even a year ago, the hawks were just talking about, getting out with honor and, being able to walk away with our heads high, but McCain is talking about victory, and I think it is part of a payback or blowback or reflection of the Vietnam experience.
And Greg Mitchell, I'd like to talk about the surge now, because that is sort of the dominant new development and the differing interpretations of the surge. But before you go into the surge, could you talk about something you mentioned in the book, which I thought was really interesting? I think you call it the Freedman Unit. You write about that and what that is, because it sort of, I think, encapsulates a lot of understanding the last 4 or 5 years.
Well, I didn't coin it. People have, years ago, noting that Tom Friedman, the widely honored and best-selling columnist for the New York Times, who supported the war from the beginning, every 6 months he would write a column in which he more or less would say, and sometimes would say so explicitly, things are not going that well, but in another 6 months, things will turn around. And if it
doesn't, I'm going to be in favor of a pullout. And then another 6 months would pass, and he'd write another column that would say, if things don't turn around in 6 months, I'm going to be for, you know, going in the other direction. And it's, so it became almost a joke, and then people kind of started categorizing it and finding this trend, and so it became known as the Friedman unit of 6 months. So some people then started, if they talk about a two-year period, they would talk about that's four Friedman units. Or, you know, one Friedman unit from now, you know, they'd be talking about 6 months from now. So it had a nice comedy aspect to it. But I think, as I mentioned earlier in our chat here, it did symbolize what I would say vast, vast majority of editorial pages and pundits everywhere were saying, where one every 6 months or time would pass and you'd, people would wring their hands about the war and they'd say it's not going as well as we hoped, and you know, it's being badly run by Rumsfeld and so forth. And then they'd say, but you know, we think things will turn around, and you know, next year at this time we expect things will be better, and so we're going to hold off judgment.
And so the
Friedman unit stands for, I think, a general response.
And it seems like the surge fits right into that approach.
Yeah, well, I have a chapter in the book that's called Surge Protectors. And I wrote at the time, and again, I think I was the first person to do this, about a week or 10 days before Bush announced the surge, which was a year ago, January, that there was, I mean, forget about pro or con, there was almost no discussion of it in the press. It was, everyone knew it was coming. Bush had been talking about it for 2 months. The Iraq study group had been widely endorsed by editorial pages, and yet Bush had put it off, you know, and had said, well, Iraq study group's all well and good, but I have my own plan I'm going to be announcing. It was widely assumed he was going to call for a surge, and yet there was not a single editorial page that in advance said anything about it. And editorial columnists didn't say anything about it until just, you know, just before it was announced and then after it was announced. So there was this period where very much like the run-up to the war, where the media could have weighed in and possibly forestalled something, and instead they went to sleep. And it's really the most tragic, you know, next to the run-up to the war itself, it's really the most tragic period in the entire five-year period, because once again, there was a chance to possibly stop something, and the media once again went to sleep.
Well, what I was referring to, Greg Mitchell, also was in recently, especially during the presidential campaign and the debates and the commentary, the punditocracy, and now I'm primarily talking about broadcast and cable TV, and that, I understand there's a difference between that and print, but there's been sort of a general consensus, if I can say it, that the surge has basically worked, that it's been an effective tool, that this Friedman unit's beginning to pay off, even if it doesn't mean we leave. That's sort of an irony. And how well do you think, by the surge's own standards, it actually has been a great success? I mean, how is this based on just sort of the administration saying it's working, or is it based on hard journalism saying it is working?
Well, there's no question that compared to past years, the surge has produced results. There's no question. And so when left wingers or whatever go on TV and say nothing's better and it's just as bad as ever and so forth, it's completely false. It doesn't do anyone good to pretend that this massive infusion of troops has not produced some calming. The question is, you know, is it producing enough? B, what happens, you know, in the future if and when we pull back? Even McCain, you know, his vision of the future is not that we're going to have 160,000 troops there going out on night missions and, you know, getting into firefights. His vision is that we have fewer troops, and they're mainly, you know, keeping things down a little and training. So the question still is, what happens after our involvement becomes less, and also, has this surge and this somewhat calming experience produced much in the way of political advancement, gotten the Iraqis to get their act together? And there's much less evidence of that. So I think there's something on both sides. I think there are people can rightly claim that it's had some, you know, it's had some calming effect, but it's also right to raise all these issues about the long-term success,
political success, and you know, whether it's worth being there forever, and in a way letting the Iraqis themselves off the hook.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Greg Mitchell, editor of Editor and Publisher, author of the brand new book, So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. Our phone number here at WILL AM 580-333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Greg Mitchell, one of the things you write about, a lot of these incidents in the book, one in particular I'd like you to talk about, if you would, which is the Pat Tillman affair, which has sort of slipped through the cracks. It got a lot of attention early on and then sort of went to the back pages, so to speak.
Right. Well, you know, I probably most people know the general story, which was this great you know, National Football League star who volunteered to go to Afghanistan, served with his brother there, I think.
Yeah, sacrificed right. Millions of dollars in salary.
Right, and then was killed, described at the time, heroically in Afghanistan in a firefight and so forth. And then it came out many months later, many, many months later, that actually it was friendly fire and there had been a real cover-up. And so I think every once a year, there's some sort of congressional hearing. There's a flurry of press coverage. New revelations come out about the cover-up, and you know, how it was used, how his death was used to help sell the war, sell the war when public protest was beginning. You know, several years ago, manipulation of his death and so forth. So it's it's a case that I suspect we'll continue to read about. But it's one of the, you know, 120 kind of scandals that, you know, kind of you're reminded of them and you say, yeah, whatever happened with that? Or why didn't anyone lose their job? Or why didn't someone go to jail? I mean, you can just count them over and over, and this is going to be one of those cases where probably the Tillman family is never going to be satisfied.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. We're on the air with Greg Mitchell. Line 4, John from Farina, you're
Hi.
On the air.
Hi, thanks again for a great show. I've said this before, I'll say it again, the Iraq war is not a war, it's an occupation, and I find myself saying Iraq war just so people understand I'm referring to the thing that they're thinking of. It's an occupation. Vietnam was an occupation. We weren't at war against, well, at least against the government of South Vietnam. It's different here, though. We're not at war with Iraq. We're occupying Iraq. Anyway, it's like George Orwell with the 1984 thing, that you drill a phrase like that over and over till everybody has to be on the same page. I'm sure everybody knows this, but anyway, I think the Judith Miller case, and could you comment on this? I think it was a neocon job. I think it was, and my biggest clue was when on one report only that I heard on NPR, they talked about the stars of the neocon world visiting
right.
her in person in jail. I mean, the big guys.
Even John Bolton from the UN. Was,
Baker, Kissinger. I mean,
right.
I'm serious. They went in person.
Right.
And okay, the other thing I'd like you to comment on, and they do this constantly in the media, and you just did it yourself a little bit ago. I'm not criticizing you for this, but you quoted polls in the lead-up to the Iraq war. Well, millions upon millions of American citizens went out in the street to protest in many different protest marches, and cumulatively millions and tens of millions of people around the world protested before and just after the invasion.
Right.
And if you could comment on that. It just
gets... Okay, let me get to some of these.
Yeah, you got a big assignment here, John.
Thanks again.
Thank you. And I should add, Greg Mitchell, before you respond to your assignment there, that these are issues you write about at some detail in the book.
Right. Well, on the polls, I think I did mention that 40-50% in the polls said they were opposed to opposed to going into the war at that time. So that was sort of an endorsement, I think, of what he's saying, that people in the streets were protesting. And, you know, my point was that there was significant opposition to fighting the war at that time. On Judith Miller, there's a lot in the book about her. It was a great subject for us because it combined the editor and publisher's real, place in the world, which was covering the newspaper industry, with someone who was deeply involved with the war and so forth. So we covered, and very, not only critical of her and her coverage, but also how the New York Times handled it.
It's one of the strongest parts of the book, I can
say.
You
forget how the Times hierarchy handled her and defended her and so forth. The Judy Miller saga is, and as far as being neocon, I mean, I think it eventually did sort of come out who her friends were and who she was affiliated with and her political connections there. Oddly, she was, in the 1970s, she was part of the progressive journalistic chain, Pacific News Service.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure what one of his other questions.
I think you covered the waterfront pretty well there.
Yeah.
Last week, Greg Mitchell, we had as our guest on the air in timely manner Alex Gibney, the Oscar-winning documentary maker,
right,
who made the film Taxi to the Dark Side,
right,
about the use of torture in Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and in Afghanistan. And as I read your book, it raised so many fundamental questions I think all journalists and people who think about journalism have to be concerned with. And just recently, we're having debates in Washington about waterboarding and whether the United States should be permitted to torture or not be held to the same standards that it used to be held to in the use of torture. Ethically and morally, journalists covering stories like this, I mean, how do they cover something like a debate over waterboarding? And let me put this in context so you understand where I'm coming from. I think if we had, another country had had a debate over, the news media was taking waterboarding seriously as a legitimate enterprise, and it was a country we didn't like, say Venezuela, and their state media were doing that, I think it would be probably suggested that was really a poor media system that wasn't, had very little morality.
Right.
How does a working journalist or a journalistic institution deal with a debate on waterboarding without without just sort of like, you know, how, is there an ethical role for journalism?
Well, you try to cover things, anything from the dark side that you find out about, you cover if you can get around the national security secrets pressure. We certainly have seen Dana Priest at the Washington Post and various New York Times stories that have revealed things that at least publicly the administration and Pentagon and so forth were very upset about. Reporters have certainly during the same period have produced pieces that were quite shocking from the dark side. We also know there was, the New York Times was pressured to hold stories and did hold stories, certain stories, for quite some time, and then came out with them. So it seems like the press, at least the reporters, might be all in favor of getting the stories out right away, but sometimes the publishers and editors still are willing to hold stories, when they feel or they're told to that they really need to hold them. So I don't know. In terms of waterboarding, it's been excuse the expression, drip 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 of coverage over the last year, and a lot of editorials have come out against it and have lambasted the Bush administration. And here, after all this, what happens just this week or this weekend? It's once again the administration now, after denying we even did it, then said yes, we do it, and now they're saying we're going to keep doing it, and it's and it may even be torture, but we don't care.
Our guest, Greg Mitchell. We've only got about 10 minutes left. We have three callers waiting patiently to speak with Greg Mitchell, the author of So Wrong for So Long. So I just asked the callers to try to make it as brief as possible so we can get everyone on the air. Let's start with line one, Urbana. You're on the air with Greg Mitchell.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say I think I'm one of those left-wingers who thinks that the search was a failure, that the conservatives and Republicans have a tendency to create these narratives which they stick to like glue and repeat endlessly. And what happens is that a lot of that narrative gets taken up in the news media. And with the surge, basically, because there's been some, decrease in U.S. casualties and that all of a sudden that's declared as the success, but if you go back to what the original goals of the surge were, right, both in the military and political aspects of it, none of those things actually happened.
Right. Well, I think that I pretty much said that when I said that people went on the air and sometimes said what I was saying was that they were sometimes went on and said nothing had happened, that there were no improvements and so forth. Certainly the debate of whether it's been a success or a failure is a very open debate, but as you just did, you did say that there have been some progress in some areas, and I think that's the place to start from and then go into asking whether that's enough.
And also what the cost is and what actually will come out of it in the long run or in the near term. Let's go now to line two. Effingham, you're on the air with Greg Mitchell, author of So Wrong for So Long.
Yeah, thank you. What I've been noticing over the last couple of years, I'd say, and I think it sort of applies to your Friedman unit thing there, is that what the Republicans are really doing is they're stalling for time. They know they've lost the government. They're probably going to lose the presidency. And they're looking quite a bit further down the road than I think of the media is looking. And how are they going to regain power in the country? I think the way they're going to do it is the same stunt they used after the Vietnam War, which is once the Democrats are in, they're going to start a drumbeat of lost in Iraq because the Democrats are sissies.
Right.
That's what they did after the Vietnam War. It worked very well. It resonated with, a large chunk of the American people, and they're going to do the same thing this time.
Right.
And I think a lot of the strategy that they're using is very similar to what they used after the Vietnam War. And if you study a lot of these neocons, a whole lot of them, from Wolfowitz to Rumsfeld, were pretty, they were very affected by the Vietnam War. They were young men. They had the wrong position at that time. They were very embittered by probably the criticism they took for having the wrong view at the time. And this was their big chance to reclaim their position and prove that they were right all along. And you're going to see that over the next few years. It's going to be Rush Limbaugh and all the dimwits are going to be running this line. And are people going to expose it for what it is or not?
Thank you very much. Line two. Do you have some comments on that, Greg?
Only that no question the Vietnam. Every few years, it's said that we're finally beyond Vietnam and the Vietnam experience is over and lost its grip on America, but we're continually reminded that Vietnam is still very much alive. It's sort of the signal most important event of a lifetime of anyone, from the age of 40 onward, which is an awful lot of people. And
both of us.
Vietnam is still very much with it. In fact, in the book, I was bringing up Vietnam parallels with Iraq, just in terms of that we were going to be stuck there for a long time, and people made fun of it and mocked me and so forth, and so here we are 5 years later.
It was a few weeks ago, Greg Mitchell, I was watching a TV show, I think it was the Bill Maher show on HBO, and he had a comedian on, and he also had a Bush administration person on, I forget who it was, I think it might have been Tony Snow, but I'm not certain, and the Bush administration person was making a comment about basically all the same sort of charges about Iraq now being made, I think, about Iran and Venezuela. And the comedian basically said, look, I don't believe anything you say about anything after Iraq. What was striking about it, and this gets to a theme that comes out in your book, is that comedians can say that, but journalists can't.
Right.
Isn't it interesting that Colbert and Stewart and Maher and this comedian can just say, look, you guys have lied through your teeth, so I'm not believing you anymore.
Right, right.
But a journalist says that, they're not a professional journalist.
Yeah, well, that's one of the problems we've got into. I think the mainstream journalists often respond to these disputes by saying on the one hand this, on the other hand that. They quote an expert on one side and they quote an expert on the other side, and then they kind of walk away from it. And I agree that I think we do need mainstream journalists, and we need relatively objective coverage. There's so much opinion on blogs, including my own, and websites, and shows like yours and so forth. There's so much opinion and so forth, and that's fine, but we still do need some mainstream reporting, and it just but on the other hand, when it's so even-handed, you actually lose the truth. You don't get at the truth. Sometimes you have to sort of say, look, this is the way things are, and yes, we'll describe the other argument, but we're not going to pretend that it's a 50-50 argument.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Greg Mitchell, editor of Editor and Publisher, and the author of the brand new book, So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed on Iraq. We have a couple of callers. Let's try to get to both of them. Line three, Robert from San Francisco, you're on the air.
Hey there. Vietnam is still with us, but I don't think we have learned anything from it. I just wanted to say that I think it's easy to scapegoat the neocon sympathizer Thomas Friedman when the reality was in 2004 the Democrats wanted to outdo Bush on the war, and they consequentially shut down the anti-war movement. They're doing it again with this new campaign, and as to the surge, it would be surprising if something didn't work, because the U.S. spends more on wars in Afghanistan and Iraq than Russia and China do on their entire defense. And that's my comment.
Well, thank you. Let me just rephrase that or channel this question, if I can, for a quick comment by you, Greg, which is, how do you think the war debate is going in the presidential election so far? Is it getting a fair hearing from the candidates? Is the public getting a chance to really weigh in on the war?
Well, I did a column a month ago, I think, where people were saying that the war was no longer a hot issue, and nobody cared about the war anymore, judged because based on the political debates, televised debates. And of course, this was absurd because all the Republicans agreed on one approach and all the Democrats agreed on another approach. So, you know, you're not going to have a hot issue. Now, as I said then, imagine if the fall campaign was starting next week and you had Obama versus McCain, or even Clinton, Obama, Clinton versus McCain. I mean, look at the divide there. You may feel that the Democrats are not strong enough and they're going to sell out in the end, but you could just imagine the debate between McCain's view and the Democrats' view.
Let's go to our final caller in our last minute. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Greg Mitchell.
Hello. I would like to hear your comments about the mainstream media getting it wrong in terms of being driven by circulation and advertising and about wanting to reach and excite consumers about consuming more media rather than excite them about the issues of our times.
Right.
I'll hang up and take your answer.
Okay. Well, that's a big, multifaceted question.
And you get a minute to answer it, Greg.
As you know, there's been massive cutbacks in the mainstream media, and they're putting more and more energy into websites and blogs and so on and so forth, and shutting down foreign bureaus and shutting down Washington bureaus and so forth. So the trend, whether it's politically oriented or not, or war-related, certainly the trend is towards reaching, doing that kind of journalism as opposed to really in-depth, tough, and foreign coverage.
Well, we only have about a half minute or minute left before we have to wrap up. Greg, is there anything else you'd like to add that we haven't gotten to that you think is important?
Well, it's all important, so I hate to go into that, but it's like I said, I think it's worth looking back at sort of how we got to this position. It's worth looking back at how the media has contributed to it, to go forward. I mean, really, my book is really to provide lessons for the future.
I don't sense from your book, if I can interrupt for a second, Greg, that you're very optimistic that the lessons have been well learned so far.
Well, sometimes I am, but then when you see the when things about possibly bombing Iran or possibly taking other actions come up, and the media repeats some of the same problems from the past, then it does get pretty discouraging, because it's easy to imagine going down that same path again.
I hear the band tuning up in the background, Greg Mitchell, which means they're trying to clear me out of the studio. I want to thank you, Greg Mitchell, for joining us today on Media Matters. Greg Mitchell, the author of So Wrong for So Long, How the Press, the Pundits, and the President Failed in Iraq. Thank you again for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
And I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my terrific producer, for arranging the show. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. I'll be back 167 hours from now with Mark Weisbrot talking about press coverage of the economy, the economic crisis, and Latin America. So you get a two for next week. Thank you all for listening. See you then. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy with a high in the mid-30s and southwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of flurries, the low in the lower 20s with light west winds. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high around 40 degrees and northwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for Public Telecommunication, thanks to the generosity of University of Illinois alumni Alice and Robert Campbell. This is WILL Urbana, the listener-supported broadcast service of the University of Illinois. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. New Orleans was the site of the 9th Annual State of the Black Union Symposium, which convenes African-American thought leaders to converse on America's major challenges and opportunities. Today, we share excerpts.
This is the gulf that Du Bois talked about when he talked about the gulf between what we say we're doing and what we live into.
The very idea that race would be the issue of the 21st century should be unacceptable to us.
We'll hear from Professor Michael Eric Dyson, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, PolicyLink CEO Angela Glover Blackwell, Xavier President Dr. Norman Francis, New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin, and others who take on some of the top issues confronting Black America. This hour of the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, after the news.